just had, I think Stephen and I were talking today, and he said, kind of give me points, so he wants to do well in the quizzes, which is a good idea. So membranes, we're up to membranes now. We talked a lot about proteins, and we're going to keep talking about proteins. We're going to talk about hemoglobin and myoglobin, and we're going to talk about enzymes, which are proteins, in great detail. Different types of enzymes, enzyme mechanisms, enzyme catalysis and kinetics. Also things you will visit in the lab. That will be after the first exam. So we'll come back to proteins, so we're not leaving them entirely behind. But we're going to take a side trip and talk about membranes. And before we kind of get started in the membranes lecture, we want to keep in mind the big picture that when we're talking about membranes, we're talking about cells, cell walls, if you will, and also walls that divide up the compartments, the inner compartments of cells. So basically they're the external boundaries of a cell are made of membranes. There's some common features that all membranes have, and that is they're very thin. They're sheet-like structures, so they're only a few molecules thick. You want to keep that in mind. They contain lipids, proteins, and very small amounts of carbohydrates, which will be very important, we'll see. The lipids in membranes are amphiphilic, so they're both hydrophobic and hydrophilic in nature. And it's those lipids that really make the barrier or the wall, the membrane wall, the cell wall, which is the barrier to diffusion of certain molecules. Membranes have functions which are mediated by proteins, and we're going to see the different types of membrane proteins, which we mentioned in passing when we introduced them on Wednesday. We're going to see that they can act as pumps, as channels, as receptors, energy transducers, and as enzymes. All of the components that we talk about membranes are interacting non-covalently, so everything is based on that overall hydrophobic effect that we've been emphasizing, things being hydrophobic, hydrophilic, or amphiphilic in nature. Membranes are very asymmetrical, so they don't, when you think of them as a picture, they're not nice, even, pretty pictures. And it turns out that lipids and proteins can diffuse fairly rapidly through the plane of the membrane, but much slower in a vertical way. In other words, they can't go straight through the membrane. That's how it acts as a boundary or as a barrier or as a cell wall. So first we'll start by looking at how does it form, and we already introduced this, and it's a concept that's familiar to you if you've studied micelles at all. You know, a micelle is kind of like a circular membrane. And again, it's the hydrophobic effect that causes membranes to form and provides the driving force for lipid bilayers. And in your picture, you have a simple lipid bilayer, and all around this thing, remember, is aqueous, because water is our solvent, and everywhere we have water. And so that causes those hydrophilic head groups, and in particular, those things like the acid and the basic amino acids, which are groups, not amino acids, but in this case, we're talking about lipids, so let's not diverge. But that we're talking about the carboxylic acid part, wherever there's oxygen. Sometimes we have other groups attached to them with nitrogens. Anything that is fairly electronegative and can hydrogen bond is going to sit on the outside. The tails, which remember are basically hydrocarbons, very long ones, kind of fluctuate and they move around in the breeze. So they're kind of moving. This is not really a static picture. If we add a little film, these things would kind of be moving a little bit. It turns out that saturated and unsaturated fats pack differently. And it turns out that saturated fats, which have what's called a high melting temperature, and good examples of those are like butter and Crisco, and tends to be fats that we don't think of as heart healthy, are solid at room temperature. That's what a high melting temperature means. It means if you leave a cube of butter sitting on the counter, generally unless your house is terribly hot at room temperature, it will still be a solid. Same with Crisco. Saturated fats like that pack very easily. And so these little lipids that you see here with the really straight tails are saturated. It turns out unsaturated fats, these ones that kind of shoot out in all different positions, don't pack as easily and have a lower temperature of melting or melting temperature. And those are your what we think of as better fats like olive oil and canola oil and all of the vegetable oils, which are things if you went to the store and bought would be in a bottle because, of course, they're liquids at room temperature. You can't just leave them sitting on the counter or because they're liquid, they will just melt all over. So there's different packing depending on the type of fat that we have. There's one compound that wedges itself in here and is part of most membrane structures that gets in there inside those little long hydrocarbon chains, and that's cholesterol. So cholesterol goes into membranes and kind of wedges its way in there, and it impedes the motion of the tails. So the one compound that makes membranes less fluid is cholesterol. So if you can visualize it, it basically moves in here and sticks itself in there. And then these guys can't move around, because remember, they're all moving, kind of like flagella that you saw in biology when you look in a microscope. They're all kind of waving in the wind. Here's another picture, again, of saturated versus unsaturated. And you can see the saturated are much straighter. They pack more easily. Remember, unsaturation is an organic chemistry term that means it has double bonds in it. So unsaturated fats have double bonds, polyunsaturated have multiple double bonds. And you remember when you talked about the chemistry of the carbon-carbon double bond, that it's rigid. There's no rotation about that bond. A carbon-carbon single bond, you have rotation. You have rotation. Just like the alpha carbon in our amino acids, there is rotation about that carbon. But the minute you get a double bond, it can't rotate. So unsaturated fats are kind of like stuck. And so they give a little less fluidity to the membranes. Anything else? Do we have the hibernating animal story in there? No. Okay, the hibernating animal story is that it turns out that animals that hibernate, such as bears, of course, hibernation meaning they tend to go to sleep in the early winter, and they sleep through the winter in a cave or some sort of shelter, and then come out in the spring to eat and feed and so on. It turns out that hibernating animals, before they go into hibernation, are able to increase the extent of unsaturated fats in their membranes. So through their diet, they increase the number of unsaturated fatty acids, and their membranes pick up those unsaturated fatty acids. And basically then, when they hibernate, this increased degree of unsaturation kind of keeps the membrane from almost freezing up in a way. And so when their body temperature keeps dropping, because it gets quite low, quite a bit below normal, then there's still a little bit of movement in there, so that if it got rigid, of course, that would be bad, then the cell would die. So it kind of keeps their cells alive while they sleep for long, long periods of time. That's the hibernating animal story, which won't be on the test. The fluid mosaic model. This is a very typical picture, and unfortunately here it's not in color. There's beautiful color pictures of it, I'm sure, in your book. Is the fluid mosaic model, and again, that's just a big term. It's a nomenclature term. It doesn't mean anything specific, except that everyone presents the fluid mosaic model when we talk about membranes in introductory biochemistry. And basically, it's a picture of a membrane with all of its components, not just the lipids. Here's the lipid bilayer. Remember, it's pretty thin, so we've just got two lipids. Here are some saturated, unsaturated. You can see the difference in the little chains here, so they're all moving around in here. We got our proteins now associated with the membrane, and we're going to talk about each of those in turn. We'll talk about integral membrane proteins, peripheral membrane proteins, and there's the carbohydrates. Some of them, notice, are stuck to the lipid, to the head group, and some of them are stuck to proteins. And those are those little branchy things that look like antlers sticking off there. And again, this is a permeability barrier, so only certain things can come in and out. Depends on the specific nature of the membrane and where it's found. And we've got the proteins, we talked about that. And it turns out that lipids can travel through this thing fairly quickly in this direction, and so can proteins, but they go much more slowly this way. So of course it's providing a barrier this way, it's basically a cell wall. So the cell only wants certain things to be able to come in and out. And again, that's dependent on the specific cell and the specific membrane. Those carbohydrates, we talked about this, we talked about glycosylation. There are four that are very commonly found attached to membranes. So the membrane carbohydrates are glucose, galactose, fructose, and mannose. Those are four simple monosaccharides, four simple sugars, glucose, galactose, fructose, and mannose. And again, they attach themselves either to the lipid or to proteins on the membrane by a glycosidic bond. Remember that hexoses can be linked from any of five or six different positions on the molecule. So there's lots of OH groups. And that's what gives us a vast diversity. All of those little branching chains can be pretty much infinitely put together. It's exponential the ways that we can make those little antlers sticking off of the protein that we saw. And that gives these membranes high information content. Which, remember, the key to high information content is it allows cell-cell communication and recognition. Because remember, this is the outside of a cell. So it's what another cell next to that cell sees. It's what your body uses, its immune system uses to recognize itself, its cells as self or foreign invaders. Remember again, proteins and lipids can be glycosylated. For proteins, the amino acids most likely to be glycosylated are asparagine, serine, or threonine. Asparagine, you would have an N-linked glycosylation. Serine and threonine, remember those are our two amino acids that have hydroxyl groups, and that would be an O-link. So those four sugars, glucose, galactose, fructose, and mannose, all of the different hydroxides on those sugars can attach directly to the protein or lipid, and then other sugars attach to it, and we get all these little branches sticking off that are important for cell-cell recognition and communication. And as you know, that's a pretty hot topic of research in which some of you may be involved, actually, in research that has to do with cell-cell communication and recognition. Basically, all of the autoimmune problems, all of those things have something to do with cell-cell recognition communication. Cancer research, AIDS research, all areas of research on cell-cell communication. How do they talk to each other? Again, asymmetry is a key word when you talk about membranes. Everything's asymmetrically oriented. The membrane itself is not exactly flat. All the proteins, as you can see, are sticking in different places. All the carbohydrates, everything's asymmetric. One of the things about the asymmetry is that it allows us to have pumps. We're going to talk about pumps, and so transport can be driven in one direction, and it allows them to have receptors that are specific for specific small molecules, and in particular things like hormones that can bind to the outside of a membrane. Of course, we also know that the carbohydrates on the membrane are very asymmetric. They're all over the place, and there's lots of different ways they can be attached. Associated with membranes are things called sphingolipids and glycolipids. Glycolipids, we've already talked about. A sphingolipid is basically a type of glycolipid. It's a little more complex. They are found in brain, blood cells, and in particular in lung surfactant. And we're going to go on and talk about lung surfactant in a little bit more detail. And this is an example of one. You don't have to be able to draw these. Remember, the only structural things we need are the amino acids. So this is what one looks like. This happens to be sphingomyelin, which is a very common sphingolipid. And the main features of it, again, are its amphiphilicity, the same with glycolipids. And that is, we have a very polar hydrophilic head group, loves to hydrogen bond with water, so it's out on the outside in contact with water. And again, here's our very long, notice there's 12 of these CH2s, hydrocarbon tail, which likes to go to the inside. So sphingolipids and glycolipids are very big components of all the different types of membranes. A clinical correlate, before we move on and talk about membrane proteins, a clinical correlate is blood group antigens. There is a way of typing blood, determining what type of blood you have. It's called the ABO blood group. And basically, the ABO blood group antigens are distinct sugars, polysaccharides, found on the glycolipids of the red blood cell membrane. So those little branchy guys that we saw in our picture, let's remember. Here's our fluid mosaic model. So those little branches on the outside, ouch, from the glycolipids, sorry, woke you up, are distinct on the red blood cell membranes. Well, these little branches are constructed in the ER and Golgi apparatus, because that's kind of where we construct things. That's like the UPS. And it's specifically directed by enzymes called glycosyl transferases. Remember ASE, that tells you it's an enzyme, glycosyl transferases. Well, it turns out that individuals express different glycosyl transferases, and thus each blood type is then characterized by a different polysaccharide structure. So everybody's, not everybody, but individuals with A, B, O, AB blood have distinct glycosyl transferases, so distinct little polysaccharide structures on their red blood cells. And again, we can look then at those glycosyl transferases for any given individual and determine then whether they're going to be A, B, O, or AB type blood. So we can actually look at those enzymes, isolate them fairly easily, and type your blood as A, B, O, AB. Now clearly, remember the carbohydrates, this is another example of how they're important. They're there in very small numbers, are very important, but also for cell-cell recognition and communication. And in terms of recognition, clearly, if a person was in the position where they needed blood and you put in the wrong type, this would cause a very severe immune response because the body would say, okay, I do not recognize these polysaccharides on these red blood cells. These are not mine. And it would attack them, of course. It would cause a severe immune response. So you don't want to do that. So clearly some sort of blood typing would be in order before just pumping blood into an individual who needed it. So that would be part of the immune response. And again, part of recognition is those carbohydrates. Your red blood cells recognize your red blood cells. And if you have A type blood, recognizes those specific polysaccharides that are made from the glycosyl transferases for A blood. So again, the carbohydrates, really important part of the membrane. A bigger part of the membrane are those big globby things that we see sticking in it, and those are the proteins, the membrane proteins. There are a couple of types, peripheral membrane proteins, which are either extra or intracellular, and integral membrane proteins. And I go back to my picture again. So peripheral, extracellular, those are those guys sitting on the outside. Peripheral intracellular are those guys sitting on the inside. Integral are those guys that stick either all the way through or part of the way through the membrane. So peripheral means they sit on the inside or the outside. Integral means they're stuck in or all the way through the membrane. Peripheral proteins, as you can imagine, can be pretty easily removed, and they kind of float in and out. Especially the ones that sit on the outside can come and go. Even the inside ones can come and go. So extracellular peripheral proteins, these blobs that sit on the outside, tend to be receptors, protein ligands that are specific receptors, can bind small molecules. The intracellular ones, again, are attached to the inside part of the membrane, and they can be modified covalently depending on what membrane they belong to, so they can be kind of specific to a membrane, get a specificity about them by being modified. And it turns out that a lot of those peripheral intracellular proteins are oncoproteins, and that is kind of precancerous proteins, and that is, as they're modified, if they become somehow malfunctional, it's been found that they might have some kind of cause-effect that causes the cell to go crazy, which is basically, in the most simple terms, what a cancerous cell is one that no longer has control mechanisms. It grows out of control. So these modified proteins that sit on the inside, peripheral membrane proteins that are intracellular, have been found to be oncoproteins. The integral membrane proteins are those ones that stick through, either all the way through or partly through the membrane. They cannot be easily removed. Basically, you cannot remove them. You can, and you can take the membrane and destroy it, so basically peel the membrane away from the protein, but it can't come and go, so it doesn't associate and dissociate. It stays with its specific membrane. It spans the bilayer. The part that goes through the membrane, some that can stick out and in, the part that goes in is almost always alpha helical in nature. And it kind of makes sense. It's almost like a corkscrew kind of thing. It can screw itself into the membrane, and it does that with the alpha helical part. And there's basically three classes of integral membrane proteins that we can talk about. We can class them. One is an antigen, which we're going to talk about more when we talk about antibodies and antigens. Again, immune system, immunology. They can be receptors, and they can be translocators. So antigens are basically integral membrane proteins that are recognized by antibodies. And antibodies are basically your immune system response. You can go to the antibody antigen lecture and read a little more. We're going to touch on it. It's a very brief introduction to immunology, which of course is the whole science in itself. So an antibody is the thing in the white blood cells that recognize things as foreign and destroy them. So that's part of our immune system. And it turns out that antigens are integral membrane proteins. So proteins that sit inside membranes of invading cells like bacteria and viruses that are recognized by our antibodies. Receptors are very, very important integral membrane proteins. They are required for the action of all of our hormones and transmitters and growth factors. And it turns out that under the class of receptors, there's three classes of types of receptors. There's growth factor receptor tyrosine kinases, also known as RTKs, small molecule 7 transmembrane helix receptors, which are G proteins, and receptor channels. The RTKs bind hormones like insulin. They are very complex in structure. The insulin will bind extracellularly to the part of the protein that's sticking out of the membrane. They have a single alpha helical transmembrane domain that goes through the membrane. And then the intracellular part, the part that's sticking out inside the cell, it's a very complex system. It's got a lot of tyrosine residues, and it has to do with phosphorylation of tyrosine residues, and that activates many other proteins, and there's a whole cascade. And finally, you get the physiological or biochemical response for a hormone such as insulin. It works through an RTK. We will look in detail at the insulin receptor, but it won't be till next semester. Again, if you want to read more about it, it's on the website. We introduced small molecule 7 transmembrane helix receptors because they are G proteins. Something we'll hear over and over and over again. You do not need to know for this exam how a G protein works, but we will introduce it here, and we will definitely see it again many times. The types of hormones that work through G proteins are the epinephrines, also known as the catecholamines. Those are the hormones that give you what's called the fight or flight response. That's your adrenaline, when you get a shot of adrenaline from some sort of threat that's either perceived or real. They work through G proteins. And glucagon, which is kind of the sister hormone to insulin, also works through a G protein, through a 7 transmembrane alpha helical receptor. This is a little picture, cartoon, if you will. It's called 7 transmembrane because there are 7 pieces of protein. And again, that whole thing is the chain, the protein starting from, you'll notice the N terminal going to the C terminal is all amino acids. It goes through the membrane 7 different times. Each of these 7 times that it cuts through, it's alpha helical in nature, and it kind of corkscrews through the membrane, so it's kind of complex looking. The way it works, the way a G protein works, is pretty much the same for all of them, so I gave you a general outline. Again, you do not need to know this specificity of how a G protein works for the exam, but know that a G protein is a type of receptor, which is an integral membrane protein. And the basic way a G protein works is a hormone binds, this is the membrane here, so here's our lipid bilayer, and the hormone binds to the outside part, because that's where it recognizes receptor, so receptor, hormone, receptor substrate recognition. It binds, and there's basically a piece of the receptor called the alpha subunit, which migrates and touches a peripheral membrane protein, which is intracellular. Notice it's sitting on the inside of the membrane. So this subunit touches it, and that activates this. And then there's a whole, again, cascade of events that goes on. And finally, you get the response, physiological or biochemical, say, from the adrenalines. That would be that response that you feel when your adrenaline comes in. Your heart rate increases greatly. You sweat. You feel activated, ready to act, which is good because it's in response to a threat that either you perceive as a threat or a real threat, like a bus is actually coming at you, or you think someone is in the shadows, that would be a perceived threat. Whatever, your adrenaline comes in, and you get basically heightened metabolism, heartbeat, everything goes into a high state. That all occurs way down in here. After this protein is activated, lots of different proteins are activated, deactivated, phosphorylated, very complex. And we will talk more about that. But again, an introduction, these are G proteins. So the class of proteins that are 7 transmembrane receptor proteins are G proteins. Then the last class, receptor channels. There's not actually a specific note in the lecture about receptor channels. So we saw the growth factor, the RTKs tend to be hormones like insulin. These are G proteins. And these are very simple receptors that act as a channel, so I didn't give you any further details on those. And so I want to direct you as where we are and what we're talking about. We talked about antigens and receptors, and now we're going to talk about translocators. So we're going into now the third class of integral membrane proteins, which is translocators. So we're leaving receptors. And number 3 is translocators, or as I like to call them, transporters. Transporters makes more sense to me. Major function of these is to transport things. Hence the name transporter, I think, makes more sense. Remember that the membrane is acting as a wall, as a permeability barrier. And this allows the cell to let only certain things in and certain things out. Generally, the way you think about it, the most logical way is what comes in would be things like nutrients, what goes out would be waste. That's the most basic way that transporters would work. There's 2 types of transport, active and passive transport. Passive transport is the simplest thing, and that is basically diffusion. So we're talking about simple diffusion or facilitated diffusion, where the compound binds with a molecule and is actually diffused through with something else. But in all cases, diffusion is going basically with the electrochemical gradient. So basically, positive, negative, acid-base chemistry is setting up a gradient, and things can diffuse slowly through the membrane this direction, so going in. So here's nutrients, say, diffusing in to the cell through the membrane. So that is passive transport. Active transport goes the other direction. Notice active transport is going against the electrochemical gradient. Therefore, active transport requires energy. It is a pump. It is what you know as a pump, a cellular pump. So it's pumping things against the gradient, requires energy. The most famous pump is the sodium ATPase, also known as the sodium pump or the sodium ATPase pump. The reason we hear so much about it is in the plasma membrane of all mammal cells. So really, really important pump, and it is our example here then of active transport, so going against the electrochemical gradient. And overall what it does is it pumps 3 sodium ions out of the cell and 2 potassium ions into the cell, but it costs us energy in the form of 1 ATP molecule. Remember, we've hinted at energy in the body basically works as an ATP. That's where we get energy from the phosphate bonds in adenine triphosphate molecule, which is a ribonucleotide molecule. So we use one of those, and we pump out sodium and pump in potassium. Again, why this pump's important, it's in all mammal cells. The pump is generally coupled to something. In other words, we usually get kind of a bang for our buck, if you will, a sale, and that is usually as we're pumping out the sodium and in the potassium, there's something coupled with it like glucose pumping into the cell. So at the same time the cell is pumping in sodium and out potassium, it's also taking in some nutrients. So that's what this picture is to show you. It's usually coupled to something. You do not have to draw these pictures. They are much more detailed than you need to know. Again, the key to focus on is there's 2 types of transport. Passive, which is diffusion, so it goes with the gradient, doesn't require any energy, simple, something diffusing. And active, which requires energy because it's going the other way. It's opposing the normal flow, the electrochemical gradient. So that kind of, in a nutshell, is membranes, which again keep the big picture. We're talking about cell walls, cell-cell communication, cell-cell recognition. Parts of membranes are made primarily of lipids, of course. Glycolipids, sphingolipids, they've got proteins stuck in and around them and on the outside and the inside and through them. And, of course, carbohydrates attached to the lipids and the proteins. So membranes. So that's it as a new material. This is the end of the material that will be on the